Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with actor Frank Langella about his tell-all or most memoir.
Almost each and every famous person I met had not only another side, but a deeper, more profound terror, if you will, or fear of holding on to all those outside things.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Poet Kevin Young discusses his non-fiction book, The Gray Album.
Black culture is very much the basis of large parts of American culture, and I was trying to identify those and think about them.
Andrew Dalbanco discusses the new essay collection by Marilyn Robinson.
I think of it as if she's allowing us to overhear the thought process that lies behind the narrative creation in the novels.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news.
This is John Williams, the book's web producer at the New York Times. Sam recently sat down with the actor Frank Langella to discuss his new memoir, Dropped Names, Famous Men and Women as I Knew Them.
Frank Langella, there are a lot of famous people here. They're glimpsed fleetingly. How come?
Well, some are fleeting, as in 30 seconds, and some are long weekends, some are 7, 8, 10 weeks of work, and some are lifetime friends. And they're all different moments in my life in which I was able to meet a fascinating person and became totally dazzled by them according to my age. I starts out when I'm 15 and goes until I'm now 72, 73, stopped then 2 years ago.
Well, we see Marilyn Monroe and Loretta Young, we see President John Kennedy.
Yeah.
And you make it clear from the outset that you're not going to pretend these people weren't famous and that their fame wasn't important to you. It actually almost is about the quality of fame and celebrity. How do you approach that?
Well, I don't know that there's a theme in the book, but after I read it, I came to see that there was a certain kind of pattern of what, in fact, fame, money, awards, position, sex appeal, booze, pills, all the things, all the toys that we use to keep ourselves from ourselves, that become far more available to famous people, can destroy as well as elevate. And I came to see that almost each and every famous person I met had not only another side, but a deeper, more profound terror, if you will, or fear of holding on to all those outside things, so that as they got older and older and older, there was very little center in a lot of them, very little sense of self. So, you know, the Eastern philosophy is whenever you feel nervous or scared, throw something out of your box, if you're a box. Those of us here in this culture keep packing our boxes with things like fame, like money, like success. So as we get closer to death, we're very heavy. We're weighted with all those things. And I was 15 when I met Marilyn Monroe for a second. She was the first person I'd ever met outside my world. And then as a result of being an actor, I would find myself watching the President of the United States dance on a coffee table, sip tea with the Queen Mother at a horse race, try to ride a horse and stay on it with Robert Mitchum, and meet extraordinarily interesting, beautiful women like Rita Hayworth and Elizabeth Taylor, who were tormented people, really.
You know, something reviewers are already saying about this book is that it seems totally free of the coyness and the self-referentiality of so many memoirs by famous people. And you're also very blunt in your assessments, even of some of your own heroes.
Yes.
What gives you the license to do that now? You're not afraid to say what you think about whomever?
No. I'm not sure that it's license as much as it is. It's my opinion, and it's the truth of what I saw. The title is As I Knew Them, and in the foreword of the book I say, this is not the way necessarily that someone would paint themselves, and it's not necessarily the way Sam Tannenhaus would say, well, I met Robert Mitchum and he wasn't that. It's my perception of someone with all of their difficulties and warts. It's never cruel. It is observant, and it is at times, I suppose, dangerously, what's the word I want for that, incisive, cutting in a way, because I couldn't stop observing the things in people that were as difficult to deal with as they were wonderful. And I felt, forgive me, And I felt that I couldn't bear the idea of writing a book that was honey, darling, baby, sweetie, which is what most biographies are. They whitewash memoirs, or they just whitewash things, and that's not how life is.
You could also be difficult on yourself, for instance, with
yes.
Jacqueline Onassis.
Yeah, purposely.
Mistakes.
I felt that if I was going to reveal the things about other people that I was shocked by or put off by or angered by, I better well say how difficult a young man I was, how arrogant I was, how certain I knew everything, and how the decades have affected me. And also how, when you run up against someone like that, you often dislike people for whom you, in whom you see the qualities you don't like in yourself. So sometimes when I ran up against someone like, say, Anthony Quinn, who was imperious and grand, I got upset because it reminded me of the periods of my life when I was imperious and grand. You know, you just get mad at people sometimes who are too much like you.
Something else people have noticed, me included, this book is really written, is writing something that you've been interested in for a long time. Have you thought of yourself as a writer as well as an actor?
But it means the world to me that people are saying that it's well written. I think it means more than anything else because I worked hard on it. I went over it and over and over to try to make you feel as if you were sitting next to me in a room and we were having a cup of tea and I was telling you, I'll never forget the night that Bob Mitchum said to me, and still make you feel that it was more than just chatter.
And how much all the great acting you've done, including stage work and acting and speaking some of the greatest lines ever written, what impact does that have when you're writing the words?
You know, that's a great question. No one's ever asked me that. I have a feeling that I've written in a style that I most loved when I was a boy growing up in the... Do you remember Cornelia Otis Skinner? Are you too young to remember her? You probably are. She's a wonderful writer, and I love wit, and I love Ogden Nash kind of writing, and I loved the round table at the, you know, Dorothy Parker, and how do you lead a, you know, how do you, what's that wonderful
Noel
thing?
Coward as well.
Noel Coward, who's in the book, yeah. It's not a soapbox, really, but we both know we're living in an age that's far less discerning than it used to be. So language is, we're losing language, really. We're losing syntax. Everybody says, right on, sure, gotcha. Yeah, everything is in little breaks. So I wanted very much to write sentences that were, I didn't think about it. I mean, I didn't set out to write a great sentence. I just set out to try to be descriptive enough so that you'd be interested in who I was writing about, not just because they happened to be famous.
Now you're still busy, you work with a new generation of directors and actors. Yeah. Is their relationship to the language the same that you had when you worked with someone like Elia Kazan?
No, it's very different. I don't know if you noticed this in your work at all, but it's harder and harder. You know, if you want to speak in a good sentence with a subject and a predicate and all of those things, everything's a catchphrase now on movie sets, and scripts are often pared down. There seems to be a tremendous conspiracy against one thing, silence, and another conspiracy sort of against a sentence that you have to enjoy and listen to and let unfold. Everybody's trying to write it shorter and quicker and faster because they think the public won't absorb it if it isn't like a soundbite that they can get. And I always think you should aim for the highest in someone's mentality, not the lowest.
What about differences in stage audiences? How do they seem now compared to when you were starting out or when you first achieved really great
fame? It's really, really changed. And I just did a play by Terence Rattigan, a brilliant writer. Sentences that flow, language that pours out of you thrillingly, like George Bernard Shaw does, or when I played Cyrano. And the audiences liked it, but it took them a while to catch on to it. They also, Broadway audiences, are getting used to one-hour plays, one-and-a-half-hour plays, and they're getting used to people who talk in catchphrases. And I think it's the effect of television and, you know. One of the greatest, most beautiful artists in the world is a singer named Ella Fitzgerald. And if you watch the old tapes of Ella Fitzgerald singing, the camera stays on her for a whole song. Maybe it'll go to a profile. But now a young singer, the camera's way over there, then it's up here, then it's there. It's as if those people don't think an audience can sit still for artistry anymore, that they have to be dazzled, when I think it's the simplicity of art that's dazzling to me. It's so beautiful to watch a woman like Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan or the great singers of that era just stand quietly and sing.
You think we'll get a return to that? Is there some possibility, or that era has just passed?
I think Armageddon has to come, don't you? I think it all has to go right back down to nothing, and then if the few people left alive have to restart the whole civilization again. I don't mean that in any terribly depressing what I just said, but I guess it's a function of my time, my age, and my generation that I do long for things to be a little more full of humanity and soul, you know. My daughter and my son and my, they can just do this in a second, and I have to go eight like that. I'd much rather pick up the telephone and call and communicate, but they'd rather do that.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you. Thanks, a pleasure. You're easy to talk to.
If you'd like to see a video portion of this interview, please visit nytimes.com/arts. This is John Williams again, and Julie Bosman is joining me with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, John.
So the big news this week was sort of no news, which is that Monday afternoon there was the announcement that there would not be a Pulitzer Prize for Fiction awarded. So what happened?
Well, this week, as much of the publishing industry is on the other side of the pond at the London Book Fair, we had quite a bit of drama in the United States. And on Monday afternoon, the Pulitzer Prize Board announced, as they do every year, the 22 Pulitzer Prizes. Except for this year, there were a couple missing. And one of those prizes that was missing was the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction.
Is this unprecedented, or?
It's not unprecedented, but it hasn't happened in 35 years. So for a lot of people who work in the industry, it was unprecedented in their lifetimes. And it was something that most people hadn't remembered ever happening before.
And the people who, I think there was a three-person jury charged with the first step in this. And how does the process work? How do you get to the point where there isn't a winner?
It's a two-step process. There's a three-person fiction jury. And last summer, they started reading or reviewing at least 300 books that they thought were potential Pulitzer winners. And this year, the fiction jury was composed of Michael Cunningham, whose novel The Hours won a Pulitzer in 1999, Maureen Corrigan, who is the critic in residence at Georgetown University, and Susan Larson, the former book editor of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. And after those three narrow it down to three books, then those three books are passed on to the Pulitzer Board, which is an 18-member group. And they're not from the literary world, but they go and they read all three books and then make their decision.
Okay, so they did not feel that any of the three were up to the standards of the Pulitzer.
What we've been told is that the board did not reach a majority vote on any of those three books. And for people who haven't been following this closely, I should mention what those three books were. And they were Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson, The Pale King by David Foster Wallace, and Swamplandia by Karen Russell.
Now, I assume that Larson, Cunningham, and Corrigan, who read these hundreds of books, probably aren't thrilled with this. Have any of them had anything to say about the fact that their work all went for naught?
They were quite furious, and at least two of them, Susan Larson and Maureen Corrigan, have spoken out very loudly about the Pulitzer Board's decision. Now, we don't know what was behind the decision. Maybe they fought so vehemently over the merits of each book and couldn't decide which one was better, or maybe they didn't feel strongly as a group about any of the three. I should also note that, you know, these three books all have, this is an unorthodox group. Mm-hmm. There have been a few points raised about these books. One is that David Foster Wallace, of course, died before this book could be completed. It was written, but it had to be assembled by his editor, Michael Peach. Train Dreams was originally published in the Paris Review about 10 years ago as a novella. Not that a shorter book should disqualify it.
Right.
But that's one point. And Karen Russell is very young. Her book was published when she was only 29. So if you really wanted to nitpick, you could say that each of these books has something unusual about it that could have given the Pulitzer Board pause.
Right. You could argue that it wasn't a bumper crop. I was monitoring a lot of the reaction on Twitter and other places online, and it seemed like there was a lot of outrage on the industry's behalf. People felt very affronted that there wasn't a Pulitzer. What are the practical reasons why the industry feels so strongly about this?
I think the main reason is, the practical reasons are that there is no prize like the Pulitzer. That if last year when Jennifer Egan won for A Visit from the Goon Squad, the book got just an enormous lift in sales, in prestige. A Pulitzer is a very easily translatable prize abroad. It helps sell a lot of foreign rights. So it's so much bigger than the National Book Award. It's much bigger than the Booker. So for the publisher who and the author who would have won the Pulitzer, you know, it's a huge opportunity. But I think that beyond the practical considerations, the response here was really emotional. It's been a very difficult year for the book industry. Last week, the Department of Justice announced a long-expected lawsuit against five of the biggest book publishers, which in a couple of months could result in Amazon leading the way and lowering ebook prices again, which is not great news for a lot of publishers and authors. And I think that a lot of people in the industry just felt like, what more are you going to do to us? You know, what more do we have to deal with?
Is there any sense from the Pulitzer Board, or do you think there will be, that this could lead to changes now that there's obviously, through Twitter and other things, there's a more public backlash, or do you think that things are likely to stay the same?
Well, I asked the administrator of the Pulitzer Prizes that question this week, and he said the system is working, that for the most part, this year, the Pulitzer Board produced many wonderful prize winners. He didn't specifically address what happened with fiction, other than to say that there was no majority winner. But in the Washington Post this week, Maureen Corrigan, one of the judges, pointed out that she has a couple of suggestions so that this will never happen again. One of her suggestions was, why not just let the three-person fiction jury decide who wins the Pulitzer? Mm-hmm. The Pulitzer Board is not comprised of literary types. It's the Pulitzer jury that really does all of the work and spends all of the time, you know, reading 300 books or at least looking at them. Not sure how many they actually read start to finish. And she also said, look, if the board is unhappy with the jury's choices, then why not request that the jury put forward other selections? But I do think that it's possible that the Pulitzer Board might have a little bit more trouble recruiting people to serve on that jury next year.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, John.
Kevin Young is an accomplished, prolific, and prize-winning poet who's now written an important work of nonfiction. It's called The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness. It's reviewed for us by David Shields, who says The Gray Album is angular scholarship for whites, a storying songbook for blacks. Who is the liar? Who the thief? Who is telling whose history? And who is keeping score? Young forces us to contemplate who controls the music. I'm delighted that Kevin Young is here to talk about his book. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
All right, so you're onto a really ambitious thing that a number of intellectuals have been grappling with, and that's the kind of differences between white culture, black culture, how black artists and intellectuals have dealt with it. Why the Gray Album?
I wanted a title that conjured that kind of mix, and the Gray Album is based on a mashup by Danger Mouse. He took the White Album by the Beatles, the music from that, and mashed it up with the vocals from Jay-Z's Black Album. So you get the Gray Album. And the fact that he did this apparently in a weekend was also part of it. It was kind of an epic in a condensed form. And I guess that's some of what I want to do with the book. It's also a book about music and literature and a kind of mashup of those two things, and thinking about American culture as black culture and the ways in which black culture is very much the basis of large parts of American culture. And I was trying to identify those and think about them in a similar mashup kind of way.
Okay, so let's start there because that's a very bold claim. There's a huge, almost like polymorphous range of figures discussed in this book. Let's go back to the beginnings and separate out for us this idea that American culture in some ways, maybe in many ways, really derives from black culture. What's the argument there?
I guess it's partially thinking about what I call the blackness of blackness. And I was trying to think what makes African-American culture unique and its own. And large part of it is things that influenced American culture, whether it's the spirituals, the music. You can see this very clearly in music. Most music comes from the blues, which comes from the spirituals. And it's influenced, you know, a world of music, whether it's even country and Western music has its roots in the blues. And the music we hear on the radio today does too. So I was really interested in taking that idea and think of it more broadly about the rest of the culture.
Well, you do a lot with literature. So let's go to some classic literary figures. You go all the way back to Phyllis Wheatley. You work through Zora Neale Hurston. Let's talk about some of these great figures and how they dealt with the contradictions of being black and being American.
Well, I guess one of the things, I wouldn't see it exactly as a contradiction, though I do think it's a tension perhaps, but a fruitful one. And I think that Zora Neale Hurston is a great example of someone who, she grew up in an all-black town, and her view of herself, she would often argue, was, you know, she says in a essay called How It Feels to Be Colored Me, she says, you know, I don't always feel colored. And then she's trying to talk about, you know, feeling colored, not feeling colored. Often she says, I feel most colored when thrown against a sharp white background. You know, it's a very playful essay about the shifting qualities of her as an African-American. She also is a recorder of folk tales. And I was really interested in the folk tale, or what in African-American culture gets called lies. And these lies, this idea of lying, ended up becoming a kind of galvanizing force for the book.
Now, you deal with the question of lies, and you also introduce the idea of counterfeiting. And that's a complicated one. So what are you doing there?
Well, I end up calling it storying because, you know, when I was in Louisiana, where my parents are from and where they grew up and all my family still is, you know, you couldn't say to a grown-up, oh, you're lying or you lie. You'd have to say you story. And so I started thinking about, you know, these lies as kind of stories and forms of black creativity. And more specifically, I started thinking about not just, you know, ways in which African Americans, say on the plantation under slavery, use the spirituals as a coded means of escape. You know, they would often have messages in them. Swing Low Sweet Chariot, sung the night before. There's a few more less slaves there the next day. And so I started thinking about that. And then I also started talking about this idea in a jazz solo, that a jazz solo tells a story. When Louis Armstrong blows, he's telling us a story. And that was, in many ways, his innovation. And this storying aspect of African-American culture is one that I think is one of the contributions to American culture. But I also wanted to just explore it in this black context, this African-American context.
With Louis Armstrong, and is it, you mean through the improvisation that he... Is that the storying? What's the innovation there?
Yes. Well, you know, solos did different things, but it's been argued quite a bit that Louis Armstrong started the idea of, you know, beginning, middle, and end. You listen to West End Blues, for instance, the classic Louis Armstrong, and the beginning of that has that amazing trumpet.
Is that really long
call?
Note? Yeah,
you know, I wouldn't bother to do. You know, I shouldn't say, do it because I'm not as good as he is, of course. But he manages in the course of that song to take us many different places, and it's a bit of a trip, you know, and it's a bit of an emotional story that he's telling. I think also of Charlie Parker and the ways his solos returned, people said, to a blues tone, you know. And I think what they mean by that is that mix of the tragic and the comic, that quality that I think someone like Ralph Ellison or Langston Hughes or Hurston herself explored as a way of thinking about African-American culture's contributions. But in the case of Charlie Parker, you know, it's that emotional feeling that he possesses and that I think possesses us when we listen. There's also a great anecdote that I mention in the book People used to admire Parker, do whatever he said. Bird, of course, was his nickname. And he would take him to this like country western bar, essentially, and just load the jukebox full of country western songs. And all these jazz heads were sitting there just depressed, you know, hating this. And they're like, why do you listen to this? Someone bravely says one day, and he says, for the stories, man, for the stories. And this idea of the stories being told really compelled me.
Now, what about contemporary African-American writers? I mean, now we're living in a period now where there are, you know, many accomplishments, yourself or Colson Whitehead or a guy writes for us a lot, Ture, and you all have access to much broader cultural influences maybe, and your work is read in a different way. How do all these ideas filter in your own work, say your own poetry?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like there are always these wide influences, you know. And in fact, one of the arguments in the book is that, say, modernism is as much influenced by the blues and by blackness as it is by other traditions, though it's often represented as a sort of European-based tradition. And so I think when you think of it that way, then to me, being modern is part of being black, and being having these wide range of influences, it was ever thus to me. And so in my own work, I think some of it is a kind of almost hip-hop aesthetic, which is not to say one's work is in the rhythms of hip-hop, but more has that idea of sampling, of taking from anywhere. And early hip-hop especially, and I talk about hip-hop in a long chapter toward the end, it took from such weird sources, you know, Billy Joel or what have you, seemingly unfunky sources, and the goal is to make it funky, to paraphrase or quote James Brown. And, you know, I think this idea of making it funky or making it new or related.
Well, making it new, now we're talking about Ezra Pound.
Yeah. And, you know, there's even Cornelius Eady, a terrific poet. Those are the epigraphs to his selected poems, Make It New, Make It Funky. And I was trying to understand the latter as much as the former.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
That's Kevin Young, whose new book, The Gray Album, On the Blackness of Blackness, is reviewed in this week's book review. Marilyn Robinson is one of America's most original and admired novelists. She's also an essay writer of some consequence, and she's written for us more than once. Her new book is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. It's reviewed for us by another great essayist, Andrew DelBanco, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. So Marilyn Robinson is kind of an unusual case. In some ways, there's a old-fashioned Calvinist religious side to her.
There is indeed. And, you know, she takes us back really to the roots of our literature and, from her point of view, the roots of our culture. Her essays are saturated with references to people like Emerson and Jonathan Edwards, all the way back to John Calvin. And it's good to be reminded of what that tradition was all about.
And what arguments does she make? I mean, this is not the sort of evangelical we think who votes for Rick Santorum. I mean, these are different kinds of arguments.
Right. Well, I think, you know, she's very aware of the fact that we associate evangelical Protestantism these days with the political right. And one of the things she reminds us in these essays is that the tradition has had a progressive dimension, to put it mildly, abolitionism, the civil rights movement. And she takes us back in one of the most remarkable essays in the volume, from which I think readers can learn a great deal. She takes us back to what's arguably the first text of American literature, John Winthrop's sermon that he delivered en route to the New World called A Model of Christian Charity. And that sermon is often misread, I think, as the evocation of a hierarchical world where some are rich and others are poor, and God wants it that way. Robinson's reading is very different, and I think much better, which is that it's a vision of a society where people feel their obligations to one another. It's a vision of a society that's based on nothing less than the principle of love. And I think that's an important reading, and it's an important reminder, since so many public figures over the years have cited that sermon with its image from the Gospel of Matthew, City on a Hill, and imagined that Winthrop was talking about a society of competitive individuals with a new degree of freedom incomparable to what they would have experienced in the old world. That's not the whole story.
Robinson is really saturated in scripture as well. Is that right, Anna? She really knows her Bible. Is that something that contemporary writers and critics don't know the way maybe an earlier generation once did?
I think that's a fair statement. And, you know, I think I say in my review that it wouldn't be a bad idea to read her novels with a Bible concordance open on the side of the book. The essays can be read, in a sense, as a guide through the theological labyrinth that the novels do travel. I think of it as if she's allowing us to overhear the thought process that lies behind the narrative creation in the novels. The ideas in these essays are presented more explicitly. Their derivation from scriptural premises is more upfront. But if you read these essays, you develop a different relationship to the novels.
And how steeped is she in American literature and its classics?
Very deeply. I found myself thinking when I went back to read her wonderful novel, Housekeeping, where she at one point she says, "My subject is the dear ordinary." A phrase I very much liked. And what popped into my mind, and I think it's not totally off the mark, is Emerson's comment that finding the miraculous in the common is the mark of wisdom. And I think it would be fair to say that Marilynne Robinson is in that tradition, and it's good to know that it's still alive.
And are there any others, some others, who are keeping it alive along with her?
Well, you know, the late John Updike was very steeped in theological learning. He wrote, of course, a series of novels that were played variations on Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. Other writers have tried to work off the original, the inspiration of Melville's Moby Dick. Some people argue that Philip Roth is in a sort of dialogue with the transcendentalist individualism of New England. I find that a little bit of a stretch, frankly. But I think Robinson has really staked out her own territory here. Not, I don't mean by that she's looking to be novel or innovative, but this is who she is. This is where her heart lies.
Thanks so much, Andy. That's Andrew DelBanco, who reviews When I Was a Child, I Read Books by Marilynne Robinson in this week's book review.
This is John Williams again, and Greg Coles is joining me with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hey, John.
So what's new on the list this week?
On the nonfiction side of things, the top new book on the list is by the singer Carol King. She has a memoir called A Natural Woman. Then down at number 13, A.J. Jacobs, the stunt journalist who wrote The Know-It-All, where he read the Encyclopedia Britannica and The Year of Living Biblically.
Right.
He's got a new book out called Drop Dead Healthy, where he tries to live his life according to the tenets of various self-help books and diet plans. And then at number 16, the former one-handed baseball pitcher Jim Abbott has a memoir co-written with a guy named Tim Brown called Imperfect. That sneaks onto the list at number 16.
I know Abbott was a Yankee for a while, so maybe that'll appeal to New York readers. What's
yeah,
on the
fiction? He spent his career in the American League, unsurprising, since he wouldn't need to bat.
Right, exactly. What's new on the fiction side?
At number 16 on the fiction side, the writer Ron Rash, who's a poet and a short story writer and novelist, he's kicked around for years kind of on the mid-list. He's a real literary writer. As far as I can tell, this is his debut on the bestseller list with a historical novel called The Cove. He's a Southern writer, and this is set in North Carolina during World War I, based on an actual incident of a German cruise ship that was stuck in New York Harbor during that time. Hmm. Another naval story is new on the list at number 12, another historical naval story, a book called The Lifeboat by Charlotte Rogan. This is her first novel. She's a stay-at-home mom from Connecticut who raised triplets. And on and off for years while she was raising her kids, she would sneak away and work on this book. And she finally sold it, you know, shortly before she was 60. Hmm. It's gotten a lot of attention. It's also set during World War I, also about an ocean liner that explodes. And it follows what happens to some of the people who are on one of the lifeboats from that. Then at number four, Lisa Scottoline has a new book out called Come Home. She's a regular on the list. And at number one, new on the list this week, John Grisham has his first baseball novel. You can tell it's baseball season. We got Jim Abbott and John Grisham. Of course, he's the thriller, the legal thriller writer. This book is called Calico Joe, and it's the first time he's turned to baseball.
Is he a longtime baseball fan? Or?
Yeah, he's a fan of the St. Louis Cardinals, grew up as a fan of their. But, and he said that he always wanted to write a baseball novel, but just couldn't think what the story would be. He wrote a football novel somewhere along the way about a retired football player in Italy and kept trying to come up with something he could do with baseball. Couldn't think of anything until he heard the story of Ray Chapman. Do you know?
No, I don't.
In 1920, he was a shortstop for Cleveland. He's the only player in Major League Baseball ever to be killed by a pitch.
Wow.
It was actually a Yankee, Carl May, who beamed him.
Hit him in the head, I assume?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. May was a submarine pitcher. He pitched underhand, and the ball, I guess, just came out of nowhere. Chapman never saw it coming. Apparently, it hit him so hard that it sounded like it had hit the bat, and Carl May actually fielded the ball and threw it to first before he realized that
Chapman wasn't running.
He wasn't going anywhere. Chapman lived another 12 hours or so after that. They brought him to the hospital.
Is there a mystery element to the book, or is it a complete departure for Grisham?
A complete departure. No mystery at all. In fact, it's kind of a father-son story. It's set in the 70s. It's about a Mets pitcher who beans a young Cub phenomenon, brought up through the minors and popular young player. He doesn't kill him in this book, but it ruins both of their careers. And it's about the pitcher's son who years later brings the two players back together again to have some kind of reconciliation.
Sounds like a good read for the season. Thanks, Greg.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.